Prodigal Summer, Disc 6.
Lusa closed her eyes, tasting and smelling roast goat. Last time she'd celebrated an Eid al-Fitr was years ago, when her mother was still lively and well. Someone Lusa could talk to. Someone to cook with. A late winter celebration it had been then. The Muslim calendar crept up 11 days on the Christians every year. By now, Eid al-Fitr would be close to Christmas. She opened her eyes. Ricky, can you get a bunch of goats pregnant all at once? He blushed, and she burst out laughing. Not you, she said when she could speak again. I mean, if you had a bunch of female goats and a, what do you call him, a billy goat? You call them does and bucks if they're meat goats. Does and bucks, right. So what happens? Don't blush, Ricky. She swatted his arm. He was giggling like a child. I'm being practical. I just had an idea. Two huge goat feast holidays are coming up together at the very end of the year. And that means Eid al-Adha will be February, March, early April. The same time as Orthodox Easter and Passover. I can't believe this. She was talking fast, counting on her fingers and getting herself excited. I need to look at a calendar to make sure. How long does it take to make a kid? How long are they pregnant, you mean? 5 months, a little bit less. She counted on her fingers. That's November. That's perfect. A month to fatten them up. Could you get them all to, you know, don't blush. She smoothed her shirt tails, made a sober face, and deepened her voice. We're farmers, Ricky. Farmer to farmer. I'm asking your advice. Could I get one stud billy to knock up a whole field of babes at the same time? Ricky exploded, folding up on himself. I'm serious. He wiped his eyes. I think so, yeah. You can give them hormones and stuff. No, no, no. These are religious holiday goats. No hormones. Can we do it another way? It's been a long time since I was in 4-H, Aunt Lusa. But you know about livestock. How does it work? I think how it works is if you've got does that haven't been around a buck at all, and then you put them all in the field with him, they all come into season together. I'm not positive, but I think that's right. You could call up Mr. Walker and find out. Oh, right. I'm going to call up some old dude out of the blue and ask him about goat sex. She and Ricky collapsed again, starting the cow lowing in the stall behind them. Lusa tried to shush herself and Ricky, but she had to hold on to a post just to keep herself on her feet. Here, put this out for me, she said, handing him the stub of her cigarette. Before I burn down my barn. He tamped it out on the bottom of his shoe, then ran a hand through his hair and straightened up. She saw his eyes glance twice at the open doorway. It was no longer evening now, but night, full dark. You need to get home, she said. Yep, I do. Tell your dad it's okay about the tobacco. He's right. It really is what I wanted, not to set tobacco this year. Thank him for helping me stick to my principles. Okay. Now get! She smacked his thigh with the back of her hand. Your mother will think I'm holding you hostage. She won't either. They're more shy of you than anything, the whole family. I know. I'm an outsider occupying their family home. They want their farm back, and I really don't blame them. Most mornings, I get out of bed thinking I should pack my car and drive away without even saying goodbye. He raised his eyebrows. That'd hurt some feelings. Maybe that'd be my point. Even if you left, we couldn't be sure of keeping this place. My folks or Uncle Herb and Aunt Mary Edna, they could lose it next year to the bank. That's what I was thinking, too. Families lose their land for a million reasons. My dad's parents had this wonderful farm in Poland, which they lost for being Jewish. And my mother's people got run off their land for not being Jewish. Go figure. Is that true? What type of farming? She glanced up at him, surprised by his interest. The Maloofs had olive groves along the Jordan River, or so I'm told. I don't know the details. It was pretty far back. Mom was born in New York. But my dad was actually born on his folks' farm in the middle part of Poland, which people say looks like a storybook. I think they grew sugar beets. That's something, that you come from farming people. He appraised her as though she'd suddenly grown taller or older. I never knew that. She saw now that his interest was not in social history, but in crops. She'd begun to comprehend this frank pragmatism and to suspect that if she could acquire it, if she could want to, she could belong here. She shrugged. So what? I come from farming people. Doesn't make any difference. He continued to look at her. You talk about leaving. Everybody says you're going to, but you stay. There's some reason. She sighed, crossing her arms across her chest and rubbing her elbows. If there's any reason or rhyme to what I'm doing, I wish I knew it. I'm like a moth, Ricky, flying in spirals. You see how they do? She nodded up at the light bulb, where hordes of small, frantic wings glinted through the arc of brightness in circular paths through the air. They were everywhere once you bothered to notice them. Like visible molecules, Lusa thought, entirely filling up space with their looping trajectories. Ricky seemed surprised to realize this, that moths were everywhere. He stared upward with his mouth slightly open. A calf will run around that way when it's lost its mama and scared to death, he observed at last. They're not lost, though. Moths don't use their eyes the way we do. They use smell. They're tasting the air, taking samples from different places and comparing them really fast. That's how they navigate. It gets them where they need to be, but it takes them forever to get there. Go sniff the wind, however you said that. Ru'ushum hawa. Exactly. That's me. I can't seem to go in a straight line. Who says you have to? I don't know. It's embarrassing. People are watching me. I'm figuring out how to farm by doing all the wrong things. And I'm having this retrospective marriage, starting at the end and moving backward, getting acquainted with Cole through all the different ages he was before I met him. She doubted Ricky was following this, but he was respectful at least. They stood together watching the dizzying dance of silver wings through the cool air. Tussock moths, tortoises, foresters, each one ignoring the others as it wheeled on its own path, urgent and true. Aunt Lusa, you worry too much. I'm a widow with a farm drowning in debt, standing in a barn that's about to fall on me. You're right. What, I should worry? He laughed. About the family, I meant. They're just jealous that Uncle Cole went so crazy over you. But who wouldn't? You're so pretty and smart and stuff. She made a face at him, a squashed, sorrowful smile, to keep from crying. Thank you for saying that. He shrugged. And listen, Ricky, thanks for just, I don't know, making me laugh out loud. You don't know how much I needed that. Well, listen, if you need help with this goat thing. Oh, I'm just dreaming. It's desperation. What were you thinking? Tell me. He was a peer suddenly, earnest and kind. She saw something of the older Cole she'd known, not in Ricky's eyes, which were dark, but in the seriousness of his face. Well, what I was thinking was, I know this butcher in New York, Abdel Sahadi. He's my mother's cousin. He probably sells, I don't even know, 1,000 goats a year, maybe more. Ricky whistled long and low. Yeah, she said. New York City. It's all people, eating all the time. That's basically what you've got going there. But he sells almost all those goats at holiday times, all at once. So he doesn't want them trickling in all year long. He needs 500 all in the right week. If it's winter when you want one, you have to order it way ahead of time and you pay a fortune for it. You wouldn't believe what people in the city will pay for a milk-fed kid at holiday time. It's like the ordinary rules of what you can afford don't apply at those times. He was listening to her carefully and made her listen more carefully to herself. Rick, do you mind if I skip the little Ricky? You're not so little, you know. Hell, I wish somebody would bury the damn little Ricky. Okay, Rick, tell me this. Is there any possible way I could produce 50 or 60 suckling kids by the end of December? And then maybe twice that many in the spring, 4 months later? He didn't hesitate to take her seriously. You know about worming, ketosis, birthing, all that, right? It's some work. Did you ever raise livestock before? She tilted an eyebrow at him, but he was suddenly off on his own calculations. Okay, you'd have to have 2 seasons, not the same mothers, for both kiddings.
Right.
How's your fence? A fence that won't hold water won't hold in a goat. She laughed. I think I'm okay. It's electric. Really? Shoot, that's good. When'd you put that in? I don't even know. Years ago, Cole did it. It runs all the way around the main cow pasture up there. He had a bad stretch with some roving cows. That's lucky that you've got that. That costs some money to put in. I know, he told me. But he said if his cows had got over in Marietta's garden one more time, it would have cost him his manhood. Ricky laughed. All right then, lady, I think you're set up. Goats would do fine out there on your brush. You wouldn't need to grain them or hay them much. Maybe just give them some fodder after it snows. But kidding, in November, they'd need shelter. If it gets real cold, you'll need to get the mothers in your barn when they're ready to spring. You build them a little kidding pen. Jugs are called. Lucy looked up at the ceiling of the barn cellar, envisioning the space above. The door to the main gallery of the barn opened onto the hillside. She could change the fencing just a little to give access to the big pasture. If I didn't have it full of tobacco up there or stacked full of hay, I'd have some room. That's going to be your trick, he said. Getting them to settle down and kid right after it gets cold. That's not the normal season. I've never seen it done, to tell you the truth. Oh, that must be why goats so expensive in the middle of winter. Oh, yeah. They'd be worth gold to somebody that wanted them. But do you think I could do it? He spoke carefully. It's possible. I think everybody in the county would think you were crazy for trying it. How about if nobody but you and me and that cow in there knew what I was up to? And especially if nobody knew about my cousin Abdel and holiday prices in New York. Oh, well then, they'd just think you'd gone off the deep end with too many pet goats. They'd think you were a city gal with her nose in a book and not one lick of sense in her head. She grinned at her co-conspirator. Not a problem. That's what they think now. Chapter 11. Predators. From inside her dark cocoon, Deanna listened to the racket of a man in her cabin. The door flung open, boots stomping twice to shed their mud at the door. Then the hollow clatter of kindling dropped on the floor. Next, the creak of the stove's hinge and the crackling complaints of a fire being kindled and gentled to life. Soon it would be warm in here. The chill of this June morning chased outdoors where the sun could address it. She stretched her limbs under the covers, smiling secretly. Getting up to a warm cabin on a cold morning without having to go outside for firewood first, that was tolerable. She felt something sharp against her leg, the plastic edge of one of his strings of condoms at the bottom of the bed, twisting there like a strand of DNA. She'd been astounded when he first produced these packets of cheerful little rubber discs in the primary colors, a whole procession of them strung together as if they'd come off some giant reel of condoms somewhere. "That's my stash," he'd said, utterly nonchalant, pulling them out of his pack like a magician's tied-together scarves from a sleeve. He claimed to have gotten them free at some walk-in clinic that urged them onto its clientele. She disliked thinking of his ambling into such a place for treatment of God knew what. Didn't really care for the grim realities of this man at all. The fact that he was a seasonal migrant picking up occasional work, salmon fishing, carving knife handles for cash. A male who shacked up for shelter, she suspected. She'd done her best to run him off, flying into her rage at him up in the chestnut log, yet he persisted in her territory. He'd been out several years from Wyoming, with his hunting rifle, following his passion, which they did not discuss. He talked about everything else instead, and she found herself swallowing his stories like bits of live food brought to a nest. The northern lights unfurling like blue-green cigar smoke in the Arctic sky. The paraffin-colored petals of a cactus flower. The Pacific Ocean and tide pools, neither of which she'd seen except for the artificial versions of the latter in the Chattanooga Aquarium. She thought now of the pink anemones waving in that water. Like herself, when he'd first spied on her with her sensitive, fleshy tentacles of thought waving all around her, until he'd touched and made her draw up quickly into a stony fist. But he knew just how to touch her, speak to her, breathe on her to draw her out again. Physical pleasure was such a convincing illusion, and sex the ultimate charade of safety. The stove's metal door banged shut, and she heard the hush of his jeans shed onto the floor. Her body tingled with the anticipation of his return to her bed. She waited, though, and for a minute too long, there came no body diving headfirst into her world under the quilts. She poked her head out into the morning and blinked at its brightness. It was late morning already. The sun was a dazzling rectangle at the window, where a naked man danced in silhouette, batting both hands at a frightened moth. "Hey, hey, careful," she cried, causing him to turn to her. She couldn't see his expression because he was backlit, but already she knew that face, its guilelessness. "I wasn't going to kill him," he insisted. "I'm just trying to catch him and put him outside. Little booger snuck in here. He's trying to see you naked." She sat up and squinted at the desperate wings flailing at the window. "No, now that's a female. She's looking at you." "Hussy," he said, trying to clap the moth between his hands. "Look at her. She's terrified. Never saw such a display of manhood in all her days." "Don't do it like that." Deanna lifted aside the heavy pile of blankets and put her feet on the cold floor. The wood stove radiated a tangible field of heat that her body passed through as she walked to the window. "Best if you don't touch it. The scales will come off its wings."
"And that would be terrible?"
"To the moth it would. I think it dies or something without 'em." He stepped back, deferring to this dire claim.
"Is that a scientific fact?"
She smiled. "My dad told me, so it must be true." She tried with her cupped hands to steer the moth away from the window. "Darn it, little wing, I'd open this window for you, but you picked the only one that doesn't open."
"Who's your dad, a moth scientist or something?"
"Don't laugh, there are moth scientists. I knew of one in graduate school." She tried to urge the moth toward the window over the bed, but nothing doing. It continued to throw itself eastward like a supplicant toward Mecca.
"Maybe if we close the curtain, she'll go to a different window," he suggested.
"Maybe." Carefully, she drew the white curtain between the moth and the glass, but she could see that it wasn't going to help much.
"She can still see the light," he said.
He'd believed her when she'd declared the moth a female. Deanna was touched. "You know what? I can't really sex a moth at 20 paces. I was bluffing. And no, my dad wasn't a scientist. He could have been. He was a farmer, but he was..." The moth settled onto the curtain and sat still. It was an astonishing creature with black and white wings patterned in geometric shapes, scarlet underwings, and a fat white body with black spots running down it like a snowman's coal buttons. No human eye had looked at this moth before. No one would see its friends. So much detail goes unnoticed in the world. "I can't really even describe how my dad was," she finished. "If you spent 100 years in Zebulon County just watching every plant and animal that lived in the woods and the fields, you still wouldn't know as much as he did when he died."
"Your hero. I'm jealous."
"He was. He had theories about everything. He'd say, 'Look at that indigo bunting. He's so blue, looks like he dropped down here from some other world where all the colors are brighter. And look at his wife. She's as brown as mud. Why do you reckon that is?' And I'd say something dumb, like maybe in indigo buntings it's the men instead of the ladies that like to get dressed up. And Dad would say, 'I think it's because she's the one that sits on the eggs, and bright colors would draw attention to the nest.'
And what did your mama say about it?"
"Yeek!" Deanna howled, startled by the darting shadow of a mouse that burst from behind the woodpile and ran practically across their bare feet before disappearing into a hole in the corner between the log wall and the floor. "Damn," she laughed. "I hate how they make me squeal like a girl every time." Eddie Bondo had jumped, too, she'd noticed.
"Your mama said yeek?"
"My mama said not a whole heck of a lot on account of she was dead." Deanna narrowed her eyes, studying the hole into which the mouse had disappeared. She'd been stuffing holes with scraps of aluminum foil for 2 years, but anything with mice was a war you couldn't win. She'd learned that much. She realized Eddie was looking at her, waiting for the rest of the story. "Oh, it's not a tragedy or anything about my mother. I mean, to Dad it was, I'm sure, but I don't even remember her. I was that little."
Deanna spread her hands, unable really to name the hole this had put in her life. Nobody ever taught me to be a proper lady. That's the tragedy. Oh, now look, she is a she. Deanna pointed to the moth, which was pressing the tip of its abdomen against the fabric of the curtain, apparently attempting to lay eggs. My mama died too, quite a while back, he said, as they watched the moth closely. Happens, I guess. Daddy remarried after about, 15 minutes. Deanna couldn't imagine such family carelessness. Did you get along with her at least? He laughed oddly. She could have got along without me. She had her own kids. That was some of the trouble. Who the ranch would go to. The whole ugly stepsister story, you know. Deanna didn't know. My dad never did remarry. No? So it was always just you and him? Did she want to tell him this? Mainly me and him, yeah, she said. He had a friend, but that was years later. They never moved in together. They both had their farms to run, but she was good to me. She's an amazing lady. I didn't even realize until just lately how she'd been through hell and back with us. My dad was a mess on her hands at the end, and she had a little girl, too, with Down syndrome and a hole in her heart that couldn't be fixed. My half-sister. Eddie Bondo put his hands on Deanna's shoulders and kissed her. This is you, isn't it? She ran a hand through his hair, newly shorn to a smoother shape, less crow, more mink. On Tuesday, her day of mortification after assaulting him in the chestnut log, she had let him talk her into many things, including cutting his hair with her little scissors. It was surprisingly thick, like the pelt of some northern animal that needed the insulation. The exquisite tactile pleasure of that slow hour spent out on the porch with her hands on his scalp had created between them a new kind of intimacy. Afterward, they'd stood quietly watching a pair of chickadees gather up the fallen hairs for their nest. Me? No, she said, unsure what he meant. My half-sister, Rachel was her name. It's who you are, I mean. You're telling me a piece of your life. She looked at his eyes, watched him glance back and forth between her own two pupils. He was that close. Our bed's getting cold, he whispered. I don't think that's possible. The fire cracked loudly then, like a shot, startling them like the mouse had, making them laugh out loud. Eddie Bondo ran for the bed and leaped under the blankets, hooting that the posse had found him out. She tugged at the edge of the bed, fighting him to let her in. I reported you to the Forest Service, she warned, keeping a wildlife manager from her work, which is a hanging crime in these mountains. I get my last meal, then. He threw aside the covers to reveal himself, solemn and flat on his back. She pounced and tried to pin him, but he was strong and seemed to know real wrestling moves. In spite of her size and longer limbs, he could have her tidily turned with an elbow pinned behind her back every time. In less than a minute, she was helpless, laughing as he straddled her. What is that, Bondo? Some kind of sheep herding maneuver? Exactly. He gathered a thick skein of her hair in one hand. Next, I shear you. Instead, he kissed her forehead and then each one of her ribs before nuzzling his head against her waist. But she tugged him back up to the pillow beside her. She needed to look at him. Okay, she said. You're saved. I'm giving you a stay of execution. Governor, I'm your slave. She wanted to play, but her mood was wrong for it. Speaking aloud of Nanny and Rachel had brought those two into this cabin. And her father, too, especially him. What would he have made of Eddie Bondo? I told you something about me, she said. Now you have to tell me one thing about you. He looked wary. I choose which thing, or you get to ask? I get to ask. A serious thing? To me it is. He rolled onto his back, and they both stared up at the ceiling. Its crooked log beams riddled with the small tunnels of beetles. Deanna thought about the trees they had been once, a long time ago, suffering more in life than in death, surely. There was a scratching sound coming from the space above the roof boards.
"What's up there?" he asked.
"On top of those boards? Cedar shingles, rotten, probably. See all the nails? Then galvanized tin on top of the whole mess?"
"I mean that noise," he persisted.
"Mouse, probably."
"The same one that just made you squeal like a girl?"
She narrowed her eyes. "Different one. One of his innumerable friends and relations." They both stared for a while at the roof, their eyes following the sound as it moved higher toward the peak. Deanna decided the motion was too slow for a mouse and considered the other possibilities.
"Who built this cabin?" he asked her.
"Guy named Walker, Garnet something Walker. There was this whole line of them, all with the same name, kind of like land barons in this area 100 years ago.
"And this was the baron's luxurious abode?"
"Oh, not hardly. This was just the headquarters for one of his 100 logging camps. He and his sons logged out all these mountains. This was probably one of his last stands. The cabin is 1930s or so, I'd guess, looking at the logs."
"What are they, oak?"
"Chestnut, every one. When people realized the chestnuts were dying out, they had this huge rush to cut down all that were left, even the standing dead wood." He studied the construction more closely.
"That's why the logs are kind of small and twisted?"
"Yeah, deadwood, or maybe some of the bigger limbs off huge trunks they took for lumber. But Eddie, listen." She turned to look at him. "What I'm saying is, they realized the chestnuts were going extinct. So what did they do? They ran up here and cut down every last one that was left alive." He thought about it.
"They were dying anyway. I guess that's what they figured."
"But not all of them would have died. Some of those last chestnuts were standing because they weren't sick. They might have stood straight on through the blight."
"You think?"
"I'm sure. People study this stuff. Every species has its extremes, little pockets of genetic resistance that give it an edge on survival. Some would have made it." She watched his eyes track the twisted logs as he pondered what she'd just said. This was the thing that surprised her again and again. Eddie Bondo paid attention. Most men of her acquaintance acted like they already knew everything she did, and they didn't.
"If some of the chestnuts had lived," he asked, "how long would they have stood?"
100 years, maybe. Long enough to spread their seeds. Some of them did live. There's maybe 5 or 6 per county hidden back in the hollows, but there aren't enough to pollinate one another. If more of them had been spared, they could have repopulated these mountains over time, but nobody thought about that, not one person. They just sawed the last ones down, hell for leather." He turned his acute gaze on Deanna.
"That's why you live up here by yourself, isn't it? You can't stand how people are."
She weighed this, feeling its truth inside herself like damp sand. "I don't want to feel that way," she said finally. "There's people I love, but there's so many other kinds of life I love too, and people act so hateful to every kind but their own." He didn't reply. Was he taking her judgment personally? She'd been thinking of people who refused to be inconvenienced for the sake of an endangered fish or plant or owl, not of coyote killers per se. She forced her next words, knowing that each one had its own cost. "You said I could ask you a question, and now I'm asking it."
"What?"
"You know." He blinked but didn't speak. Something in his eyes receded from her. "What brought you down here to the mountains?" He looked away.
"A greyhound bus."
"I have to know this. Was it the bounty hunt?" He didn't answer. "Just say no if the answer's no. That's all I want." He still said nothing.
"God."
She let out a slow breath. "I'm not surprised. I knew, but I will never, ever understand who you are. I never asked you to. No, he hadn't, and she would refrain from trying if she was capable of it. But here he was, naked beside her, with his left hand lying above her heart. How could she not need to know who he was? Were male and female from different worlds, like the Indigo Bunting and his wife? Was she nothing but mud-colored female on the inside? She, who'd always been sure she was living her life bright blue? Where does it come from? She asked. I can't understand that kind of passion to kill a living thing. Not just a living thing, an enemy. Tell me the truth. How many times have you seen sheep killed by coyotes? Enough. 100? On my own family's ranch? No. 100 would wipe a man out, even if it was spread out over 4 or 5 years. On your own family's ranch, in your lifetime, how many? 50? A dozen? He was still looking up at the roof beams. Maybe a dozen, he conceded. We've got sheepdogs, we've got good fences, but even so, probably that many. You can't always tell what got them, especially if it was a lamb, and whatever got it just hauled it clean away. So in one or all of those cases, it could have been anything. A neighbor's dog, a barn owl, a damn bald eagle. Eddie Bondo grimaced, declining to agree or disagree. A coyote is just something you can blame. He's nobody's pet. He doesn't belong to anybody but himself. So great, put a bullet in him. He turned to look at her full on, propping himself up on an elbow. What you don't understand is that ranching's not like farming. It's not a vegetarian proposition. She shook her head but said nothing, beginning to feel herself recede in her own way. What was it about the West, that cowboy story everybody loved to believe in? Like those men had the goods on tough. She thought of her soft-spoken father, the grim line of his mouth stretched pale as a knuckle while he worked the docking tool and she held the bawling head end, working to castrate the bull calves. The moth on the window grew restless again, fluttering against the sheer curtain and the bright outdoors behind it. He saw her watching it and reached up to tug her hair gently. Miracle of miracles, I do believe I'm in bed with an animal lover. She looked at him, surprised. If only he knew she'd been reminiscing about castration. It bothered her a lot, his being so sure he had her number. She opened her mouth, closed it, then opened it again, a little startled at what she chose to say. I'll tell you something. If a feral cat wandered up here from some farm and started wrecking nests and killing birds and having babies in the woods, I'd trap it and drown it in the creek. He made a face of exaggerated dismay. You wouldn't. Maybe I would. I'd want to. Why? Because cats like that don't belong here. They're fake animals, introduced like the chestnut blight, and just about that destructive. Not a cat person, he decided. Once again, sure, he knew. I had cats as a kid, but people won't be bothered to fix them, so they breed in the barns and prowl the woods, and they don't have any sense about what things to take. They're not natural predators, except maybe in a barn. In the woods, they're like a firebomb. They can wreck a habitat so fast, overrun it in a season, because there's no natural control. If there were still red wolves here, the place could hold its own against a stray cat. But there aren't. Or enough coyotes, she thought. He studied this new Deanna, potential murderess of tabby cats. She met his gaze for a second, then rolled over and rested on her elbows, twirling the end of her hair into something like a paintbrush and touching its tip to the palm of her other hand. I don't love animals as individuals. I guess that's the way to put it, she said. I love them as whole species. I feel like they should have the right to persist in their own ways. If there's a house cat put here by human carelessness, I can remedy that by taking one life or ignore it and let the mistake go on and on. How much damage could a cat really do? You wouldn't believe how much. I could show you a list of species that have been wiped out because of people's laziness about cats. Ground nesting birds especially. Not the kitty's fault. No, she said, amused that her hunter seemed to be pleading the kitty's case. And it's also not a cat's idea that every life, including its own, is sacred. That's a human idea, and I can buy it for humans, but it's some kind of weird religion to impose it on other animals that have already got their own rules. Most animals are as racist as Hitler, and a lot of them practice infanticide. Cats do, lions. A lot of primates, too.
Yeah?
Yep, and I support their right to go on murdering their babies in the wild if that's how they do it, unpestered by humans. That's the kind of animal lover I am. He raised his eyebrows and nodded slowly. It's not like you thought, is it?
Heck, now I'm thinking maybe you'll go hunting with me.
She rolled onto her back. Forget it. I'd never kill just for fun. Maybe to eat if I was hungry, but never a predator.
So, a deer but not a fox? Plant eaters matter less than carnivores?
She thought about this. They don't matter less. But herbivores tend to have shorter lives, and they reproduce faster. They're just geared toward expendability. They can overpopulate at the drop of a hat if nobody's eating them.
He lay on his back next to her, at ease with this kind of talk. Like rabbits do, sure, but it's complicated. Up north, the lynx go in these cycles. Every 10 years, boom, there are thousands, and then they crash.
All the more reason to leave them alone, she insisted. There's something going on there you don't want to mess with. Maybe there'd be some plague let loose on the Arctic. She wondered if he'd seen lynx. She'd probably never see one herself.
I know what you're saying, he conceded. It's been messed with already.
What are they like, lynx? She tried not to sound like a jealous child.
Oh, baby, there's a cat you'd love. They're just like you.
How's that? He grinned, thinking about it.
About 3 parts pissed off to 4 parts dignified. They're gorgeous. If you find one caught in a trap line and let it go, it won't scramble around and run, nothing like that. It'll just stand there glaring at you for a minute and then turn around real slow and just strut away.
She could picture it. Don't you get it? To kill a natural predator is a sin.
You've got your rules, I've got mine.
She sat up to look at him. Right, but then there's the world, which has got these rules nobody can change. That's what's wrong with people. They can't see that.
And what rule of the world says it's a sin to kill a predator?
Simple math, Eddie Bondo. You know this stuff. One mosquito can make a bat happy for, what, 15 seconds before it starts looking for another one? But one bat might eat 200 mosquitoes in a night. Figure it out. Where's the gold standard here? Who has a bigger influence on other lives?
Okay, already, I get it, he said. Chill.
Chill yourself, she said. I didn't make up the principles of ecology. If you don't like them, go live on some other planet. Doing my best to run this guy off, she thought. But she couldn't go on biting her tongue. She needed this conversation.
Fine, he said. But if I'm a bug rancher, it's my right to shoot the bats off my ranch.
She leaned back against the pillow. What you're thinking about coyotes doesn't make a lick of sense. They're way more important to their natural prey than they are to livestock. I bet there's not one rancher in the whole American West who's gone under because of coyote predation.
Maybe not gone under, he said.
It's just fear, looks to me like. A bunch of macho ranchers scared of a shadow.
You've got no idea how tough ranching is.
I don't see you ranching sheep, Eddie. I don't think I can give you the high ground here.
I'll inherit 1,500 acres one day, he said,
sounding unconvinced, and she wondered what divides of kinship were concealed in that flat statement, what dreads and expectations, what it was costing him to hold his place in his family. As the daughter of a farmer who'd lost his land, she felt only measured sympathy. "Right," she said. "You'll settle down with the little wife, raise up sheep till you're old, that's the plan. Just this one little thing, you need to run around and shoot every coyote in the world first." He shrugged, refusing to absorb her irony. "I've still got some time. I like to get around, see a lot of country." Shoot every coyote, screw every woman, see the world, she thought. The strategy of prolonged adolescence. But that wasn't fair. He was also kind. He'd worked hard this morning to provision her nest, bringing armloads of firewood like bouquets. She tried to put aside the misery of thinking too much. "Well, you're being true to your school," she said. "Willing to travel great distances to make the world safe for Wyoming sheep. You make fun, but you don't know. Sheep ranching needs all the help it can get. You're right on the edge of busted all the time." "What don't I know? You start down that mountainside and you'll come to the edge of a field, okay? From that point on, you can't walk right or left without stepping on some family that's lost its farm to bad luck, bad weather, chestnut blight, change, economics, the anti-tobacco lobby. You name it, there's some farmer I know who got eaten by it. But they're not bitter. They go to work at Toyota and forget about it." "They don't forget about it," said Eddie Bondo. "They just don't have an enemy they can look at through a rifle sight." She looked at him for a long time. Thought of her father, drinking to diffuse his grief in the last year before they sold out. If he'd had something to shoot at, what would he have done? "I can't say you're right," she said finally. "You don't know that. If there's coyotes moving into this country now, they'll get shot at." "I know that. I think about it all the time." "So they're here. You know where they are." She returned his clear-eyed gaze. "Is that why you're hanging around me? You're trying to get information?" His green eyes went dark, a turmoil under the surface briefly revealed. "If that's what you think, I'll get my boots on and leave right now." "I don't know if it's what I think. I've never known what to think since the first day you showed up here, but if that's what you're after, you should go." "If that were what I was after, I'd be a fool. I know there's coyotes denned up around here someplace where I can't get a beat on them, and not for love nor money are you going to give me a clue. That's the story. Deanna, don't you think I know that?" "If I trusted you, I would show you where they are, but I don't. Not in that way, not that kind of trust." "You already told me that. The first day up there on that mountain when I found you tracking that bobcat, you told me what the deal was. I accepted."
"I did?"
"You did.
So what are we doing here?"
"Having breakfast in bed," he replied. "Trying to catch a moth without harming one scale on its fuzzy little head." She examined his beautiful face and the exquisite planes of his body, wishing she could look inside him to see what mixture of love and anger and deception resided there, in what proportions.
"How old are you?" she asked him.
He seemed surprised. 28? Why, how old are you?" She hesitated, surprised at herself, sat forward and drew the covers close around her. It was the first time in her life she'd felt uneasy owning her age. Nearly 20 years older than this man, it made no sense.
"I don't want to say."
"Damn, girl, get over that. Look at you. It takes more than 30 years to tune an engine to run like that."
"Way more than 30, she said. "More than 40.
Really?
"Yeah, really."
She thought she saw a flicker of surprise, but he covered well. "So you're 97. You're my grandma. Come here, Granny. I want to rub the rheumatism out of your bones."
As he pulled her down close to him, the fire cracked again, flaring brilliant orange in the stove's small round window. She could see the flame reflected in his eyes. "I want to tell you something," she said, holding his stare. "You're a good tracker, but I'm a better one. If you find any coyote pups around here and kill them, I'll put a bullet in your leg. Accidentally. That true?" She knew it wasn't, but maybe he didn't. "Absolutely," she said. "I might even follow you a ways to do it if I had to. That's the kind of accident I'm talking about." "A leg, not between my eyes?"
"No."
He smiled and rolled away from her onto his back, clasping his hands behind his head.
"Okay, then. I'm fairly warned."
"Fairly warned," she agreed. She got out of bed, trembling internally from the effort of acting so tough. She slipped her long flannel gown over her head and shook it down over her body like a cocoon. She took a wide-mouthed plastic cup from the kitchen cupboard and an envelope from the stack of papers on her desk. She turned it over, an old letter from Nanny Rawley, the only person who still wrote her here. She went to the window and pulled back the curtain gently, sending the disturbed moth back into its frenetic charge at the glass. On the curtain, it had left a double row of tiny eggs, as neat as a double-stitched seam. It made Deanna sad to see such a last desperate stab at survival. She'd read that some female moths could mate with many different males, save up all their sperm packets, and then, by some incomprehensible mechanism, choose among them after the boys were long gone, actually deciding whose sperm would fertilize the eggs as she laid them. Deanna studied this little moth's earnest work on the curtain. Maybe she'd been holding out for some perfect guy she believed was still out there. Too late now.
"You poor thing," she said quietly. "Quit bashing your brains out. You've earned your freedom."
Carefully, she placed the cup over the moth, then slid the letter between the cup's mouth and the glass. The trapped creature clicked against the hard plastic, but it wasn't human hands, so the scales shouldn't rub off. Deanna stepped barefoot into her unlaced boots and clumped outside, negotiating the door with her elbow, feeling Eddie Bondo's eyes on her as she went. A lynx? Was that really how he saw her? She didn't feel that elegant or self-contained. He made her talk too much. The day was gorgeous. This was summer, surely. These morning chills would soon be gone for good, dissolved into the heat of breeding season. She inhaled. Even the air smelled like sexual ecstasy. Mosses and ferns were releasing their spores into the air. Birds were pressing the unfeathered brood patches on their breasts against fertile eggs. Coyote pups, wherever on earth they lived, were emerging for their first lessons in life. Deanna stood at the edge of the porch and raised the paper from the lid of the cup, giving the cup a gentle heave to send the moth on its way. It tumbled and struggled in the bright air, then swerved clumsily upward for several seconds, grasping at sudden freedom. A phoebe darted out from the eaves and snapped the moth out of the air. In a vivid brown dash, she was gone again, off to feed her nestlings. Chapter 12. Old Chestnuts. Dear Miss Rawley, I have been greatly troubled by a suspicion that occurred to me last Friday, June 8th, in the Little Brother's Hardware. I could not help but overhear, though I did not wish to, but the conversation was quite unavoidably audible, your remarks to the Little Brothers concerning a snapper. I was wondering whether this conversation referred to your lawnmower, since I am aware this is a brand of mower commonly used in this region and sold by Little Brothers. Or is it possible you were discussing a certain event, previously known only to the two of us, involving a snapping turtle? I write to ask you this, Miss Raleigh, not because it is a matter of any great concern to me, but because, in keeping with the Lord's counsel, I feel I should advise you it is a sin that does not rest lightly on any soul to slander the good name of a neighbor who has worked long and hard these many years to serve with wisdom and dignity his county, Vo-Ag teacher for 21 years, 4-H advisor more than 10 years, and his Lord. Sincerely, Garnet S. Walker III. P.S. On the matter of setting free the so-called lizards sold at Grandy's bait store, on the grounds that some of them belong to species that are vanishing from our region, having given it some thought, I propose 3 questions. Number 1. Are we humans to think of ourselves merely as one species among many, as you always insist in our discussions of how a person might live in harmony with nature, while still managing to keep the Japanese beetles from entirely destroying his trees? Do you believe a human holds no more special authority in this world than, say, a Japanese beetle or a salamander? If so, then why is it our duty to set free the salamanders, any more than it is a salamander's place to swim up to the state prison in Marion and liberate the criminals incarcerated there? Number 2. Or are we to think of ourselves as keepers and guardians of the earth, as God instructed us to do in Genesis 1:27-30? So God created man in his own image, and God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth and subdue it. Behold, I have given you every herb-bearing seed which is upon the face of the earth, and every tree in which is the fruit of a tree-yielding seed. To you it shall be for meat. And to every beast of the earth, and to every fowl of the air, and to everything that creepeth upon the earth, such as salamanders, Miss Raleigh, wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for meat." And it was so. If the Holy Bible is to be believed, we must view God's creatures as gifts to His favored children and use them for our own purposes, even if this occasionally causes this one or that one to go extinct after a while. Number 3. If one species or another of those muddly little salamanders went extinct, who would care anyway? Just wondering, G.W. III. That was it, exactly, he thought. That was telling her. Garnet licked the envelope and pressed it shut, feeling more pleased with himself than he had in many years. As he walked out his front door and down the drive to his mailbox, he whistled "Pretty Sarah," casting it up to the mockingbird on the grain shed so he might catch up a few of Garnet's notes and weave them into his merry hymn to the day. Chapter 13. Predators. "Why would you use the word windfall to describe something lucky?" Eddie Bondo asked, revealing a peevish edge to his personality that she'd not yet seen. It was a fair question. She paused to scratch the back of her neck as they fought their way through the impossible maze of sideways trees. Now the mosquitoes were finding them. Deanna had made an unlucky choice in an otherwise perfect morning, and they'd ended up here, climbing tediously through the horizontal labyrinth of an enormous windfall. As nearly as she could figure it out, one huge pine struck by lightning on the hilltop had taken down a whole hillside of its brethren by means of their intertwined limbs. Since she'd chosen the route, she was still trying to pretend this was fun. "A windfall would be lucky," she ventured, "if you'd been meaning to spend 6 weeks sawing down all these trees for lumber." "Well, I wasn't," he stated. They'd come out this morning in search of molly moochers, as people here called them.
He'd laughed at this funny pair of words, as he laughed at her once and twice, and I might could, but got interested when she explained what they were. Morels were hardly more than a legend out on the arid pine slopes of the West, but here they were real, and he wanted to taste them. She was happy to take him looking. Officially, she wasn't supposed to harvest anything out of these woods, but mushroom populations were in no danger in the National Forest, and now was the wrong time to find them anyhow. Her dad had taught her to hunt them in mid-May, when oak leaves were the size of squirrels' ears. Even the ravenous will of Eddie Bondo couldn't make one appear in the third week of June. But they'd come looking because that was how it was with him. Some days he packed up and was gone. Temporarily or for good, she never quite knew. But when he was here, he was here. If they began a day by waking up delighted together in her bed, it was going to be a new adventure, another reason to ignore her notebooks and the trails she was supposed to maintain. Most days they neglected the trails altogether to clamber into the mountain's wildest places, straight up or down slopes so steep they had to ascend on all fours and descend on the seats of their jeans, sliding like bobsledders on the slick leaves. They discovered groves and clearings even Deanna hadn't known before, where deer browsed quietly on moss and new leaves. They were reaching the edge of the tangle. Deanna peered through, swatting a mosquito and rubbing her scratched-up knee. The day was warm, but she regretted her shorts at the moment. She could see now where they were, not very far from the Egg Creek Trail. She retied her braid into a double knot to keep it out of the branches and pushed on to the end of this tedious maze. As they emerged from the pine needles, they startled up a grouse, whose coppery tail flashed as its plump body soared horizontally with a noise like an outboard motor. Deanna stood still with her hand flat on her heart, which raised an equivalent ruckus. Grouse always made such an explosion. She wished she could have seen their chickenish cousins, the heath hens, who used to strut around in clearings with their feathers standing straight up, inflating the yellow balloons on their necks to make booming sounds you could hear for miles. Not anymore, of course. In the same plaintive tone her single friends in grad school used to complain that all the best men were married, Deanna felt like whining, "All the best animals are extinct." "Is there a season on those?" Eddie asked, marveling at the grouse, his earlier irritation now gone without a trace. She gave him a look, didn't answer. Grouse were fairly rare here. More often, she discovered flocks of hen turkeys gabbling quietly in the woods, battering the undergrowth with their wings as they struggled into low branches. They'd seen some yesterday, in fact. And there was one big old tom they often saw in the early morning strutting alongside the Forest Service road, alone, steering clear of female companionship. She unknotted her braid and let it fall down her back while she considered the best route out of here. Eddie Bondo had begun to whistle. "Shh!" she hissed suddenly. Someone or something was there in the pines above them. She waited a second to see if it moved like a deer or a man. Man. "Hey, buddy," she called. "How you doing today?" From the dark green boughs he came forward, tall and a little pot-bellied, with gray hair down to his shoulders and a small bore rifle, dressed out for jungle combat. It always killed her how these guys dressed. Like a deer would be impressed by the uniform. He was squinting at her. "Deanna Wolf?" "Yeah," she squinted back. She'd be darned if she could name him. She could memorize Latin names and bird calls, but the guys she'd gone to high school with all kind of blended together. "Sammy Hill," he offered finally. "Sammy, sure," she said, as if that had been on the tip of her tongue. Sammy Hill? Could she possibly forget a name like that? "Deanna Wolf," he repeated, directing his pleasure mainly at her legs. "I heard you's up here. I heard you near about got eat by a bear." He spoke too loudly, maybe nervous or possibly a little deaf. A lot of guys lost their hearing on tractors and mowing machines. "Yeah? That story's still going around?" "That's how Miss Oda Black tells it, but hell, I didn't believe it. Gal like you getting cold all by herself up here on this mountain?"
Hell, you haven't changed a bit.
All by herself. She glanced to the side, listened behind her. If Eddie Bondo could be relied on for one thing, it was to disappear. Well, fine, he didn't need to be part of this.
Not a bit since high school? She asked sweetly. You're saying I still couldn't get a date unless everything else female in the county had rabies?
No, now, you got that wrong. We was all in love with you, Deanna.
Well, heck, Sammy, how come I didn't notice?
He laughed. We's just a scared of you.
Now, is that why you brought your gun up here today?
He looked at his rifle, dismayed.
What, this?
I hate to tell you, Sammy, she said, sounding convincingly sorrowful, but deer season's in the fall, and now here it is June. He looked at her, blinking with the effort of his innocence.
You know what, she said. Down at George Tick's gas station, he's giving out free calendars. You could pick you up one on your way back to town.
Sammy chuckled, shaking his head.
Deanna Wolf, you!
He chuckled some more. You's just as funny as you ever was.
You too, Sammy.
She kept up the smile, waiting. She knew this routine. They were almost finished. He seemed to have a bright idea.
Hell, I wasn't aiming on shooting nothing today. I was just looking for Sang, he said. Got me a alimony payment due.
Oh, well then, she said, nodding seriously. Good thing you brought that rifle. Sang plants can get real mean in breeding season.
He chuckled and chuckled, Sammy Hill.
Tilted his head back and gave her a little wink, and then in a flash she saw him at age 16, in a different body altogether. Lean and confident, the cocked wrist tossing a wad of paper into the trash can. That Sammy Hill, the basketball player. He had a stuck-up sister, Regina, whom the boys called Queen of the Hill.
Sammy scratched his cheek with a knuckle, betraying a missing molar in his embarrassed grin.
No, now, I needed this rifle for protection, he said with make-believe conviction.
Bears and stuff, after I heard what happened to you.
Well, yeah, I can sure understand that, but now, Sammy, you could take a bear one-handed. Athlete like you, you still sink a jump shot like you used to?
His face brightened.
No, he said, blushing under his stubble.
Well, now, here's the bad news. There's no Sang hunting up here either anymore. The governor's trying to let everything on this mountain grow back. I'm sorry, Sammy, but I got to send you on out of here.
She truly felt sorry for this heavy-set version of Sammy, so early to ripen and now gone so badly to seed.
Maybe there's some Sang up on the back of your dad's farm, she suggested, up there by the fork.
You know, I bet there is.
How is your dad?
Dead?
Oh, not so good then.
Not so ornery neither.
Well, okay, Deanna said. Nice to see you, Sammy. Say hey to Regina for me.
Well, hell, Regina don't speak to me no more but to nag. Since I busted up her Camaro, I reckon you'll have to tell her hello yourself.
I'll do that, Deanna said, raising one hand in a coy little wave.
Sammy touched the brim of his camouflage cap and headed downhill, slow and awkward, with his head craned far forward in the way of tall men with pot bellies and bad backs. He had to watch his footing carefully on the steep slope. She stood waiting a long time for the molecules of Eddie Bondo to reassemble out of pine boughs and humid air. He wasn't behind her now, it turned out, but above her, standing a little to the rear of where Sammy had been. She spotted his grin first, like the Cheshire Cat's.
"Well, hail, Deanna," he mocked and spat.
"Watch it, that's my mother tongue."
"I bet those boys were all in love with you."
"Uh-huh, not so much that it interfered with their general disdain." He moved down the slope toward her, as if he'd been born to slopes. Short men really had the advantage in the long run, she decided, admiring his grace. Their backs held better. And then there was the matter of shoulders and narrow hips and that grin, the matter of Eddie Bondo. She felt a strange little interior pride that this beautiful male was her mate, at least for a season.
What the heck is Sang?
Ginseng. She began picking her way toward the Egg Creek Trail, and he followed.
That's what I thought, he said.
You ever seen any?
I don't know. What's it look like?
She thought about it. A five-fingered leaf, littlish plant, dies back to the ground in winter. It's particular about where it grows, only under sugar maples on a north slope.
And it's good for ex-wives?
She was puzzled. Oh, right, alimony payments. Good for payments of all kinds. It's hard to find, though. It's been over-harvested for about five generations, I guess.
Daniel Boone had an ex-wife?
No doubt. They could always sell it for good money, even back then, get it packed off to China some way. They walked quietly for a while. Sammy Hill wasn't looking for Sang, she confided.
No?
Nope. He'd have had a spade and a burlap bag, and he'd be a little higher up than this, and he'd be looking in the fall, not now.
You can't find it now?
I could. Sammy couldn't.
Eddie clucked his tongue at her. Bragging.
Well, it's just, you know, it's easy to find in the fall, and people do what's easy. Spring and summer, ginseng's a real shy plant, and then in October it goes careless and gets bright red berries and these yellow leaves like highway construction flags. She didn't mention that whenever she found it in that condition, she plucked off the gaudy leaves and tucked them in her pockets to save it from being discovered by hunters. She scattered the ripe berries under new groves, helping the ginseng roots to keep their secrets. Later on, when she did her weekly washing in a tub of scalding water, she'd roll ginseng leaves out of all her pockets like wads of tissue. Eddie would think she was nuts if she told him that. Hoarding this mountain all to herself was his general accusation, but that wasn't it. If no person ever saw it again, herself included, that would be fine. She just loved the idea of those little man-shaped roots dancing in their world beneath the soil. She wanted them to persist forever, not for the sake of impotent men in China or anywhere else, just for the sake of ginseng. Edibanda was curious about the roots. When they sat down in the moss on the bank of Egg Creek to eat their lunch of sardines and crackers, she took a stick to the soft black dirt and tried to draw pictures of the different forms she'd seen. One-legged man, one-armed man, they weren't always perfect. Rarely, in fact. He wasn't looking at her pictures. He was looking at her. Those guys don't scare you, do they? You chew them up and spit them out between your teeth, smiling the whole time. She looked down at her ginseng man.
What, you mean Sammy Hill?
And the best part was, he loved it. He'll go down and tell everybody he ran into this long-haired she-wolf with legs like a pin-up girl. She didn't like to think about what he'd tell. I try not to step too hard on their manhood. You do that, next thing you know they're back up here with three or four of their buddies, which can get ugly. But no, they don't scare me. She shrugged. They're just people I grew up with.
I can't picture that, he said. You with those guys. You driving a car. Going shopping? I don't really see you anywhere but in the woods.
Well, I guess it's been a while.
Don't you miss it? Any of it?
If you're speaking of high school and the Sammy Hills of this world, no, I don't.
I'm not. You know what I mean.
She tried to decide if she knew. There's some people I'd love to spend the day with, sure, and certain things.
Like what?
I couldn't even say. She thought about it. Not cars or electric lights, not movies. Books I can get if I ask. But walking around in a library, putting my hands on books I never knew about, that I miss. Anything else? I don't know. She pondered some more. I like the beach. My husband's family had a beach house in North Carolina.
The beach doesn't count. I mean stuff invented by people.
Books, then. Poems, scary stories, population genetics, all those pictures Mr. Audubon painted.
What else?
Chocolate, and Nanny's apple cider, and my border collie, if he weren't dead. But he counts. Domestic pets are inventions of man.
She closed her eyes, fishing for the taste of something lost. And music, maybe? That's something I used to love. Yeah? Did you play any instrument? She opened her eyes wide. No, but I listened a bunch. My dad played in a bluegrass band, Out of the Blue. And when I lived in Knoxville, there was this little bar where we'd go. Bluegrass and country music, people you've never heard of. These sisters used to play there sometimes. Man, they were great. They came up from Texas, I think. The Dixie Chicks. Eddie Bondo laughed out loud. Yeah, funny name. Funny you. You've been out of circulation a while. They don't play little joints anymore. You've heard of them? Me and everybody with ears. She shook her head. Amazing. Nothing stays the same down there. Nothing stays the same anywhere. She looked at him earnestly. Well, but see, up here it does. I guess there's big successes and failures going on, but they're too slow to notice in a lifetime. She crossed her arms, hugging herself. I guess that's why I like it. Nature's just safer. He leaned forward and kissed her. Tell me some more about ginseng. She concentrated on her drawing of a perfect, two-armed, two-legged, cocky little man who had no need to dig up ginseng for virility. He laid her down on the ground on top of her artwork, and they stayed there a while in the shifting, leafy sunlight, leaving their own impression of human desire. Soon they were headed back toward the cabin with nothing on their minds but their bodies. That was when they came upon the coyotes, two females hunting in the open. They were a mile or so from the hollow that fed Bitter Creek, not a place where Deanna would have gone looking for them. It was in a clearing where fallen trees had opened the canopy, letting the sun onto a patch of forest floor that now grew thick with a red carpet of new blackberry leaves. At first she thought they were dogs, they were so big. Thick-furred behind the ears like huskies, and much stockier than the scrawny specimen she'd seen in the zoo or any western coyotes she'd seen in photographs. These two appeared golden in the sunlight, arching their backs and hopping through the foot-deep foliage, one and then the other, like a pair of dolphins alternately rolling above the waves. They were on the trail of something small and quick beneath the leaves and grass, probably a vole or a mouse. They paid no attention to the pair of humans who stood with their boots frozen in the shadows. Focused entirely on their pursuit, their ears twitched forward like mechanical things, tracking imperceptible sounds. Like two parts of a single animal, they moved to surround and corner their prey against a limestone bank, tunneling after it with their long noses. Deanna watched, spellbound. She could see how efficiently this pair might work a field edge, pursuing the mice and voles they seemed to prefer. No wonder farmers saw them often and feared for their livestock. If only they knew they had nothing to lose but their mice. It occurred to her, as she watched them, that this manner of hunting might actually be helpful to ground-nesting birds like the bobwhite, because of the many passages it would open through the tight clumps of fescue. Then, without any warning that the chase was near an end, the forward guard pounced and then raised her head with a sideways jerk, snapping the mouse just once in the air like a small damp dust rag she meant to shake clean, before disappearing into the woods with her catch still writhing in her jaws. Her sister paused at the edge of the woods and turned back on them with a dark, warning glare.
This ends Disc 6.